This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, I'll talk with Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman. He's the keynote speaker for the annual peace service this weekend in Kalamazoo. But first, the recent school shooting in Florida has prompted discussion of regulations on guns, mental health, and some other factors, including violent video games. President Trump recently convened a meeting at the White House on the correlation between video games and violent behavior. We're going to discuss what link, if any, there is between violent video games and violent acts. Winnie DeCamp is a professor of sociology at Western Michigan University. He is also director of the Kircher Center for Social Research. Thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here.
So let's first of all start with how you got into this. When did you start researching or looking into the idea of video games and if there is any link to violent behavior?
Well, I think I got started around 2008. And I was fortunate enough to attend a conference presentation by Dr. Raymond Paternoster from University of Maryland. And he talked about a technique called propensity score matching. And I thought it was a really interesting technique, one that's very good for trying to detangle whether something is just a correlation or whether it's actually causal. And I wanted to apply it to something. And it was a few weeks later or maybe a few months later that I was reading some articles about claims regarding the supposed connection between violent video games and violent behavior. And I thought this would be a perfect topic to apply this method to. I managed to track down some data sets on that and started looking into it.
And the reason that correlation and causation are interesting when you talk about video games and violent behavior is why?
Well, lots of people play violent video games. And whether they play them is a matter of personal choice. And so that selection bias influences who it is that plays them and who doesn't, and how much they play them as well. And so that bias there is going to prevent us from being able to just look at a correlation and determine whether or not video games are a cause of behavior. Because the people who choose to play violent video games are, on average, different than the people who don't. And so we need to find some way to address that selection bias, the thing that makes some people choose to play violent video games and other people not.
So how do you go about then studying that exactly, figuring out who it is that does decide to sit down at any point, you know, in the evening or maybe even the afternoon and say, I'm going to play this game, which is going to have a lot of shooting and might have some blood, et cetera?
Well, that's a really hard thing to address because there's lots of factors that go into any behavior someone chooses to engage in. The technique that I use, propensity score matching, uses a massive data set, kind of a kitchen sink model, where we just throw in lots of variables to try and predict whether or not someone plays violent video games. And what we end up with is a propensity score, the likelihood that someone plays a violent video game. And then we find two people who are very similar on that propensity, one who plays violent video games, one who doesn't. So these two people are very similar on all these background characteristics, but one of them chose to play violent video games, one of them didn't, and we compare. And if we do that enough times, several thousand times, we can get enough statistical power to look at this and see, after we control for that propensity, is there any remaining effect? And my research shows that there really isn't.
So in other words, that person who chooses to play violent video games is no more likely than the person who doesn't. Again, it's controlling for the other factors that and the similarities between these two people. There's no reason to look at one of them and say, oh, well, this person has been playing some sort of first-person shooter game, which is very violent, so we should watch out for them. They are more likely to commit a violent act.
I think that certainly is what my research supports. And if we chose to go about doing that, we would have a pretty massive criminal justice effort on our hands to try and monitor so many people because hundreds of millions of people play violent video games. And so if we really did consider that a risk factor that was worth monitoring someone, we'd have a lot of people we'd have to keep an eye on.
When you're doing this sort of research, how much are you relying on the information people share? And can you verify all of that and make sure that it's accurate?
That's a great question because that's one of the criticisms of self-report data when we're asking people questions on a survey. Are they really telling us the truth? And the data sets that I've used have tried to address that concern in a number of ways. One is that the surveys are completely anonymous in design. So we have no way of knowing who provided what answers. So that makes people a little more comfortable being truthful. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone is going to tell the truth. So there are some questions on the surveys that are used to try and flag people who are lying or who are not taking it seriously and might just be filling in bubbles randomly, including a fictitious drug that we ask if they use. There's a question on there, how often do you get arrested? And one of the answers is almost every day. And so if there's enough, we can forgive one answer where they might have misunderstood. But if there's enough of these triggers, it flags the case as not truthful, and we remove that from the data set.
Do you think you have an idea of the type of person who is likely to play a violent video game?
To some extent, yes. There are certain characteristics that are correlated with that. That's something that not a lot of studies have looked at because they've been more focused on that potential outcome of violence. There are a number of characteristics that seem to be related to it. For example, whether or not one of your parents has ever been in prison, whether or not one of your parents was in the military. These are correlations with that. Whether it's causal, I really can't say that either. But the biggest factor is gender. Boys are much more likely to play violent video games. In fact, by high school, over 90% of them will have played violent video games. So that's a really strong predictor.
And of course, you know, when we start talking about a mass shooting, most mass shootings are carried out by males.
That's right. Yeah.
But again, we can't necessarily say that there's a causal link between those two things, that men are more likely to play violent video games and that men are more likely to be involved in a mass shooting.
Yeah. And that's a important point, because a lot of studies that were done early on in this line of research didn't control for gender. And really, in my research, I found you really have to have a separate model for boys and girls, because boys are just so different from girls, especially at those young ages, in terms of their aggression and their likelihood of being involved in violence and their likelihood of playing violent video games, that it just doesn't make any sense to treat them the same and analyze them together. They have to be analyzed separately.
You mentioned aggression there. Do you also have to separate that from violence, that there is a degree there, that aggression is one thing and violence becomes something else?
I think that's something that we're seeing in the research, where a lot of the research that was done on video games early looked at aggression. They were laboratory-based studies to see whether or not people might be more aggressive after playing violent video games. Things like where they would, after playing a violent video game, play another game with other people where it involves blasting them with noise or using hot sauce in a dish or something like that. And those studies seem to suggest that it was related to aggression. But more recent criticisms of that have suggested that, well, it might not really be the violence in the video games. It might be the action setting. If we had people play a game of football or basketball, would they also then have a short-term rise in aggression after that? It may be the competitive nature. It may be the fast pace of the game. There may be a number of factors relating to it other than the images that are violent.
As one of your reports noted, the American Academy of Pediatrics found the evidence strong enough to issue a policy statement saying that there is proven scientific connection between virtual violence and real-world aggression. Was that a statement where they went, in your opinion, a little too far?
I would definitely say they went too far on that. One thing to note is that they stopped short of saying that it was related to real-world violence, and I think that's an important line to make between those two. But I would say even saying that there's a definite connection with aggression is a questionable statement. Both the AAP and the APA, the American Psychological Association, have made these statements in recent years, and I think it's worth noting that in response to the direction that the APA was headed with their statement, there was a letter signed by over 200 scholars, myself included, that asked them not to make that statement, that the research that's available, the entire body of it, just doesn't support that. There is a possibility that violent video games are related to a short-term rise in aggression, but that's still debated. And even if that is true, we have so much evidence that shows that video games aren't connected with real-life violence, that making these statements, even when they do put that little caveat in there, well, this might not be connected to real-world violence, people still think that it might be. And that's especially dangerous when these statements are brought up in connection to shootings, where we clearly are talking about violence.
You wrote a piece for NBCNews.com, which found that there were several claims about people who've been involved in past mass shootings It was said that they had played violent video games. In some cases, it actually turned out that those initial reports were erroneous or very difficult to confirm. Some of these people did participate in violent video games. I'm wondering if maybe you think that we just sort of turn there first, that when we hear that someone's been involved in a mass shooting, we look and see, well, did they play violent video games, and look for anybody who says that they did.
Yeah, I think that is something that does tend to come up. Usually someone makes that statement and then other people kind of jump on board on that. We saw that with this most recent shooting where we had one politician, I believe it was the governor of Kentucky, made a statement that we need to be looking at violent video games. And shortly thereafter, President Trump made similar statements. We've seen that in the past as well. For the Virginia Tech shooting, there was an outcry against video games initially, and then it was only several weeks later that it was noted that the shooter had no video games in his dorm room, didn't seem to own any at all, and hadn't played any since he was a child. Same thing with the Sandy Hook shooting. We saw initial reports that the shooter was heavily involved in playing violent video games, and later reports did in fact back up that he played some violent video games, but the video games that he was most interested in were nonviolent ones. Dance Dance Revolution was his favorite game of choice. And even in cases where there is a confirmed link between a person and violent video game, like in the Munich shooting, I believe the shooter there was a big fan of Counter-Strike. It's important to keep in mind that those games are played by millions of other people as well. Counter-Strike is a franchise that sold 50 million copies. And so for every one person who does play a violent video game and ends up hurting people, there are millions of others who don't.
Just to play devil's advocate here for a moment, to look at it from the side of someone who you know, does question violent video games, might they say, look, you know, you're right. Most people who play these games will not. But the more of these things are out there, the more it kind of, you know, is filling up the public consciousness, the more that we have violence sort of accepted in society as part of our entertainment. Somebody out there who is, you know, maybe not mentally 100%, perhaps has some other problems, they are going to be driven to some sort of violent act. Whereas maybe if all this stuff wasn't out there, they wouldn't be driven there.
Right. Everything can come down to an individual level at some point. And so some people might respond differently to some media than others. I don't think that there's any real research that shows that that is the case with violent video games, that people who played them engaged in violence that they wouldn't have otherwise. But I think it's important to keep in mind the context of this, and that is that at the same time that violent video games, and especially realistic ones, have become more commonplace, sales are through the roof on those, we've seen massive crime drops. We are at near historic lows on violent crime in America, which is great news. And if violent video games were a major contributing factor, we might ask whether or not the violent rates would be higher than what they are now. Now, I can't say conclusively that because the rates of violence are very low right now, that means video games are preventing violence from occurring. It's possible that in a world where violent video games don't exist, the crime rates would be slightly lower. That's something that we could never really know. But the research that is out there suggests that it's not a contributing factor to violence, and the fact that we have such historic lows is a piece of that evidence. The other thing that I would note in that is that there's actually been some research that has suggested that after violent video games are released, violence actually decreases slightly, and that it may be a factor where if people are in their home playing a video game, they're simply not on the streets engaging in violence.
They're otherwise occupied.
Exactly, yeah.
So if we don't believe, and if the evidence doesn't support that violent video games would be causing violent behavior, and as you say, the violent crime rate is going down, but we do have these rather, you know, horrible events of someone, you know, shooting a school or someone going into a movie theater, you know, can we conclude in some way, or can we study in some way what it is that might be causing someone to behave mm-hmm. in that way?
Well, I think the task of what might cause an individual to have done that is best left to psychologists who can study that individual. But in terms of the broader question, what is it that generally leads to violence? Criminologists have been studying this for basically a century now, looking at empirical data to try and answer this question. And there's a lot of things that we know are related to violence. Who your friends are is a factor there. How much you're attached to your parents. whether or not you've experienced any strain in your life that might make you lash out at people. And I think those are particularly important because those are the kinds of things that we tend to see in shooters. They tend to have experienced bullying or some other type of event that ostracizes them from their peers, something that makes them more of a loner. In a lot of these situations, people were concerned about them in advance. And that's because of these warning signs that kind of mesh well with what we know is related to violence.
If someone wants to, for research purposes, look at what drives somebody to violent behavior, be it video games or anything else, do you have to do something that we would generally sort of consider taboo if we were talking about law enforcement, which is profile people? Try to find, the characteristics of someone who seems more likely act out violently.
Great question. I think the important distinction to make there is when we talk about profiling in law enforcement, we're talking about discrimination based especially on race or gender or other characteristics of a person like religion. When we talk about trying to predict violent behavior, we're not so much interested in catching the bad guys as we are in preventing the violence from occurring at all. So if we can identify someone as at risk in school, for example, we might be able to do something that might help them in some way. Now, that requires a delicate touch. You can't, label someone because that only makes the problem worse. But if we can provide some kind of minor assistance to make people a little bit less likely to engage in violence, I think that would be very beneficial. And that's really what we're looking for when we talk about what predicts violence.
And when I mentioned profiling there, I was specifically thinking of gender because, again, we're talking largely about males who act out in these violent ways. And of course, back to the video game discussion, it is men who are more likely, or males and boys, et cetera, who are more likely to be playing video games.
Right. Yes. Males are much more likely to play video games. They're also much more likely to engage in violent behavior. And the relationship between gender and violent behavior existed long before video games were part of the picture. That's really predated any of modern forms of media. There has traditionally been, in all of modern history, a relationship there where males are just more likely to engage in violence.
Whitney DeCamp is a professor of sociology at Western Michigan University. He is also the director of Western's Kircher Center for Social Research. Thank you very much for your time.
Happy to be here.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman has worked and written on social justice issues for decades. As a minister, he most recently served as pastor of St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Detroit's Corktown neighborhood near the site of the old Tiger Stadium. Bill Wiley Kellerman is the keynote speaker for this weekend's 16th annual Interfaith Peace Service. The address, which begins Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kalamazoo, is sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. It's called Breaking the Reign of the Giant Triplets. Bill Wiley Kellerman, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Gordon.
So the Giant Triplets, this is references a quote by the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Tell us a little bit about what the Giant Triplets are. What are you talking about in this speech?
As listeners would know, I hope, April 4 marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. And it's also just 1 year prior to that, exactly on April 4, that he gave a really important address at Riverside Church in New York, where he articulated his opposition and response to the war in Vietnam. And in the course of that, really the heart of that speech, was a call for a revolution of values. And he said without that revolution of values, that the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and extreme materialism could not be conquered. So at the heart of that speech were those giant triplets. You can think of them as social pathologies or issues. I tend to think of them in the context of the New Testament tradition of principalities and powers. They're actually ideological structures of powers that reign and rule even more now, I would say, than 50 years ago. So address addressing those and how we break those in our own lives and as movements is really crucial and important.
You would say that we've gone backwards on those issues in the 50 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Yes, I would say that's true. The great advances that both the freedom struggle made and what he was organizing at the time of his death, and I think it's fair to say the reason that he was killed was the attempt to bring together the three movements that are connected with the triplets, which were, of course, the freedom struggle itself in response to racism, the anti-war movement, then focused on the war in Vietnam. And what he was pulling together were the Poor People's Campaign in that following summer of 1968 for economic justice, the response to what he was calling extreme materialism. And there was a lot of momentum building for a real transformation, as he put it, a revolution of values in our culture. And I would say since that time, the extremes between the rich and the poor have only accentuated, becoming absurd in many ways. There are more people in living below the poverty line than there were in Dr. King's time. In the present moment, you know, 1 in 2 of Americans live either in poverty or in low income. So, and race is more and more explicitly the white supremacy in our country is really explicitly embraced.
One of the issues you've worked very hard on is the water shutoffs in Detroit, trying to keep water on for residents who have not been able to pay their bills. Does that fit in with that idea, that part about extreme materialism? Does that play into the idea that Martin Luther King was talking about in trying to alleviate poverty?
Yes, I would say it absolutely does. Maybe I'll say one preliminary thing to moving into the water is that there's at present a new Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival that's been initiated and is really coming into full swing as a launching of a movement. Actually, the campaign's targeted 25 states to be participants, and at this point, there are 40 states who are building for the campaign, which will launch in May and June of this year in a very substantial public civil disobedience campaign way. And I would say our situation in Detroit feeds directly into that. It is, of course, a bottom-up movement of poor people and resistance from street level up. And in Detroit, water has been a huge issue for us. You probably know, or listeners would know, that Detroit's in the process of restructuring itself physically, that we're a city that at once held 2 million people and now is about 700,000. So the logic of reducing the footprint to certain neighborhoods is waterfront, downtown, Woodward Corridor, some other select neighborhoods is part of what's going on at the present time in Detroit. But that also means there are neighborhoods that don't have a future where people are really being driven out of neighborhoods, obviously poor and black folks largely. And that's by a whole series of mechanisms. Water shutoffs is high on that list. In the last 4 years, there have been upwards of 80,000 shutoffs to homes in Detroit. And that's part of a process of clearing people out of neighborhoods, along with tax foreclosures, mortgage foreclosures, school closings that have been part of the dismantling of public education in Detroit. Church closings actually figure into that, to be honest, and just the removal of transportation, public transportation infrastructure from those neighborhoods as well.
But we hear a lot now about the comeback of Detroit, that there are, you know, young people who are moving there, that there's, you know, new development, new business, new housing in areas that for years didn't have that. Would you say that that has come at a cost?
Well, yeah, I think I'm naming that cost, and that's that people are being expelled from the city. Certainly the agenda is for, in terms of racial white supremacy and racism, it's really white folks who are being drawn back into the city, folks who have fled, corporations who fled and abandoned the city, of course, now want it back. So, yes, there's certainly lots of money for downtown development. You know, we have a new hockey basketball stadium. The land was given to Mike Ilitch for $1. The funding of that, substantially, a big chunk of that came out of property taxes, which is to say school money for schools went into the hockey stadium. So that's the kind of process that we're looking at here, where the cost to poor and black folks in the city is quite heavy.
Well, how does the city, though, manage all of that? I mean, as you mentioned, you know, Detroit's population is diminished. You are trying to bring in investment. How do you, manage a big city which is becoming smaller in terms of population, but not in terms of geography, and do it in a way that does not marginalize the poor people, the minorities, the black people who've lived there for so many years?
Very good question, and very much the question of the moment. It's not what's happening. The assault on democracy from above, where you have every major black city in the state, well, except for Saginaw, I believe, being under emergency management. At one point, half the black population of the state was under non-elected governments, and three-quarters of the black elected officials in Michigan had been replaced by emergency managers. And Detroit remains, Governor Snyder has made a big deal out of the notion that no city is currently under direct emergency management, but they're all under the emergency management law. There's still a financial review board, which has a veto power over decisions that the city council makes. So that level of control continues in one way or another. At this point, making democracy is a project from below, and neighborhood organizations and communities coming together and attempting to make decisions and build for themselves. Democracy isn't going to happen from above. Democracy is really being suppressed. It's actually one of the criteria for the Poor People's Campaign in selecting their 25 states. They were looking at voter suppression and suppression of democracy. And Michigan qualifies for that as kind of the poster child for this emergency management process that really does suppress. It is a voter suppression method. I mean, if you have an election and you're electing people who aren't going to have any power, or if you've signed a petition to get the emergency manager law on the ballot, which of course was done in 2013, the majority of Michigan voters repealed that law. Then the lame duck legislature turns around and repasses it. I mean, your votes just don't count. They don't make any difference.
Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman is the keynote speaker for this weekend's 16th Annual Interfaith Peace Service in Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
The address, which begins Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kalamazoo, is sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.